Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Natalie Singer, author of the new memoir, California Calling, A Self-Interrogation, published by Portland's Hawthorne Press. Natalie's work has been published in a number of journals, magazines, and newspapers, including Literary Mama, The Washington Post, The Seattle Times, Parent Map, Alligator Juniper, and Full Grown People, as well as the anthology Love and Profanity. Natalie won the 2013 Pacific Northwest Writers Association Award for Nonfiction and was a finalist for both the 2016 Red Hen Press and Autumn House Press Nonfiction Awards. She's taught writing at Washington State Psychiatric Facility for Youth and at Seattle's Juvenile Detention Center, and she's worked as a newspaper reporter and magazine editor. Natalie earned her MFA in Creative Writing and Poetics from the University of Washington and currently lives in Seattle by way of Montreal, Florida, and of course, California. Natalie Singer, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Natalie, I'd like to start off with something I usually try to avoid in these interviews, and that's talking a little bit about myself. But our stories have taken kind of similar paths, sharing a Jewish immigrant experience. So my grandfather's family escaped Tsarist Russia in the early 20th century, not a safe place for Jews at all at that time, and settled in New York City where I grew up. Then as a school kid, I moved out to California, Southern California, by way of Phoenix. And now here I am in the Pacific Northwest in Portland. Can you talk a little bit about your family geography? Somewhat of a similar path.
Yeah. Oh, almost identical, practically. I'm thrilled to hear that. Well, yeah. So my ancestors came from Eastern Europe, and a lot of them came from, like you said, Tsarist Russia, mostly around the turn of the 20th century. And they came to all different parts of North America. Some of them ended up, most of them came through Ellis Island, and from that point they scattered. So some of them ended up in different parts of Canada, and some of them ended up in different parts of the United States. And, you know, at that time, there wasn't much choice about where you ended up. If you knew someone, anyone, even a loose connection, even a former neighbor or a distant relative who was already over over here and could sponsor you, then that was the city that you ended up in. So a lot of my relatives kind of scattered that way. And then my direct family took root in Montreal, Canada, and that's where I was born. And I lived there until I was 16 when I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area.
And that's all in the book. I just wanted to provide a context for listeners. Now, in your generation, and I'm older than you, probably a whole generation older, mine before you, the land of dreams and myth was California. In my great-grandparents' generation, it was the New World, New York City and points elsewhere like Montreal. And you have a great quote in the book, and if I was forced into distilling the book into one sentence, this is the one I'd pick. Geography is a never-ending dialogue between the real and imagined. How did that dialogue about California start for you?
Well, I don't remember the first time I heard about California, but I know I was very young, and my my parents were music fans, and my father in particular loved to, he had a huge record collection, and he loved to listen to records, and his favorite band was the Beach Boys. And so, you know, I was probably like still in utero when I was hearing that. And so my parents painted this picture really for me first about California as this kind of magical, mythical place where the sun was always shining and the palm trees were waving and anything was possible.
You have a great passage early in the book about your family in flight, literally and figuratively from Montreal to California. They're on an Air Canada flight, specifically the Bay Area. And I wanted to provide a context for listeners and also give them a feel for the book. So I wondered if you could read a passage for us from California Calling that, that kind of gives that information.
I'd be happy to. For one thing, we didn't look at all like each other, which makes sense. Among the five kids, we sprung from three different fathers and two different mothers. The seven of us were a hastily and sloppily assembled family, like a project for the school science fair. From afar, we might have looked fine, natural, but up close, globs of glue seeped out from misaligned corners, popsicle sticks were crooked, the whole thing could topple with the flick of a finger or a puff of wind. The materials used to construct our family were off-brand, heavy with the industrial scent of aftermarket problems, death, betrayal, shame, abandonment. We were the Brady Bunch, minus the upbeat tempo, conspicuously second chance, stepfamily awkward. We were all searching for something, but we didn't quite know what. If we had known, I don't think we'd have told each other. But I didn't care. None of us did. What we were heading toward was bigger than a natural, perfect family. In that plane, over the next 6 hours, I would cross over into what I hoped would be my own version of freedom. By the time the plane touched down at the San Jose International Airport, I would be unburdened of the pressure of my old high school, the weight of family secrets that burned like a brand, and the loneliness of my existence in the nowhere of the North. Something was calling to me. California.
Oh, thanks, Natalie. And that kind of introduces California as this this place. We'll examine some of the themes in the book as reinvention, as myth. California's geography, as the body. There's a lot of metaphors going on in there, and that introduces us. It's interesting you mentioned the Brady Bunch. I had to look that up, where they actually were located. They said they never really mentioned in the show, but there were a lot of references to Southern California. And yes, there's a Brady Bunch house in North Hollywood. So they were Californians, the perfect family in the perfect area of the country, the perfect region.
Yes, and I used to watch reruns of that show. When it first ran, it was a little bit before my time. It was more of my parents' show. But my parents passed down a lot of their kind of anchored culture, pop culture to me. And so I used to watch reruns of that show. And that's what I always imagined, was that they were a Southern California stitched together family.
And from a family, I can't really say broken, I think that's the wrong word, but a family that has so many parts to it.
Absolutely.
The mothers, fathers, kids. The Brady Bunch must have been this kind of ideal of, again, this stitched together family, but one that got along and just thrived.
Yeah, it was the way that things could go right.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, as mentioned in the subtitle of the book, California Calling, A Self-Interrogation, the book is structured as a self-interrogation, and it's organized into several parts, four of which mirror the stages of cross-examination at an actual hearing. And I looked this up, so it's a fact. There's formation, preparation, interaction, and completion. And each smaller section within those parts starts with a question. I have a few examples. What happened in the library? Where are you really from? How do we know this is true? Or even statements like, you obviously knew where this was heading. It sounds like you want to have your cake and eat it too. And the rest of that section is usually your response. How did you come up with that structure? I was at your Powell's reading. You mentioned that you originally wrote this as a straight narrative.
That's right. I did. I originally tried to write this as a straight kind of coming of age narrative, structured, you know, like we see some memoirs structured and a lot of novels structured. And it began to feel to me like that wasn't really the right structure. And so I started to think, you know, in a lot of ways, I have a very maybe average or relatable story. I definitely had some dysfunctional family, but don't we all, or don't many of us? So I thought, you know, I need to pull out some themes, and this book should be thematically driven. And I started to think about, you know, what are my most salient memories? What are the things that haunt me and obsess me besides California itself? And I kept coming back to this memory that I had of being in a courtroom on a witness stand as part of a custody case, and I was called to testify. And it was really a moment at which it was kind of a turning point in my life, this moment. I was 16. And I started to think about interrogation. I was interrogated on that witness stand, and when else in my life have I been interrogated, and what role does interrogation play in my life? And I realized it plays a huge role. And in some cases, was really damaging or kind of got in my way. And I thought, I need to structure this book as an interrogation itself in order to investigate that and in order to put myself in the place of the interrogator for once.
I have a quote from the book, actually, that kind of explains that a little bit. You have this sentence, asking questions then is a kind of granting of permission to oneself, an entering into a state of permissiveness. Interrogation is a taking possession of one's being, a reclaiming a voice. a very constructive and positive view of interrogation rather than this kind of negative view that you had and most of us had of getting asked questions and being put on the spot.
Absolutely. And I wanted to, because I realized I had this very negative association with interrogation, and as most of us would if we've been interrogated, I wanted to kind of turn that upside down. And, you know, when we are interrogated in different ways and at different points of our lives, and we talked about our ancestors earlier and our both our ancestors in trying to move to a new place on the map had to be interrogated in order to be given permission to move. And so interrogators are often gatekeepers and they hold all the power and we are at their mercy when we're being interrogated. And so I wanted to, I think, kind of wrench some of that power back and kind of control the narrative. And so, you know, it was really, it did put a positive view on the concept of interrogation because I was able to use it as a form of self-inquiry and I was in control of it.
And going back to our shared past here, our the religious past, the Jewish experience, in a previous interview, you actually mentioned this, that questioning is part of being a Jew. We're constantly questioning ourselves and our religion. It's encouraged in a lot of ways. That I don't even think there's a concept of blasphemy or heretics in Judaism, not usually. And there's that stereotype, of course, of Jews answering a question with a question. You ask somebody, are you angry? And they say, why should I be angry? And so do you view this in a way of form following content?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I take a lot of comfort in that, you know, as a person who is Jewish and has kind of had that experience of diaspora and of feeling in a lot of ways that I'm disconnected from my cultural heritage. You know, when I moved from Montreal to California, I was moved out of an area and a community where there were a lot of people who had a shared cultural heritage with me and moved into a place where not only were there really not any Jews where I moved to, but because I wasn't in a large metro area, I was in a kind of Northern California suburb. But I, for the first time in my life, I came into contact with people who had literally never met a Jewish person before. And I was in the position of explaining to them what that was, making them feel comfortable, trying to put them at ease, trying to paint myself as, oh, I'm the same as you, I'm the same as everyone else. And so this kind of heritage of questioning and self-questioning, and, you know, some people call it a kind of neuroses, which I agree with. It's really important to me because at times in my life, that has been kind of one of the only ties. I might maybe haven't been surrounded with or by anyone else from my culture, but I'm questioning myself repeatedly and obsessively and kind of investigating the reasons I'm here and the reasons I feel the way that I do. And that's a very Jewish experience. And so that's been a point of connection or grounding for me.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Natalie Singer, author of the new memoir, California Calling, A Self-Interrogation, published by Portland's Hawthorne Press. And another Jewish experience, I wanted to get into some of the themes of the book, and it's actually a universal experience for every immigrant, is the theme of assimilation, at least the attempt to assimilate. Jews, of course, have been wandering all over the world. There's never been a homeland. Israel, I guess, is something now. But really, we've been kicked out of almost any place we've ever lived and tried to go someplace else and be accepted as part of that culture. So you include a quote in the book from two sociologists, Robert E. Park and Ernest W. Burgess. And here's the quote, assimilation is a process of interpenetration and fusion in which persons and groups acquire the memories, sentiments, and attitudes of other persons or groups, and by sharing their experiences and history, are incorporated with them in a common cultural life. And then a few pages later, you write in your own voice, not the sociologist's voice, to assimilate in California would mean to live. To not assimilate, I knew before I even left the invisible walls of my hometown, would be to fail to live. And that view seems to stem from America as a melting pot, which was at one time considered a good thing, but right. That's being questioned now with issues about cultural appropriation. Your book, I think, takes a wider view of assimilation, both the good and the bad.
Yeah, I think that's true. And assimilation, and maybe this is true for many other immigrants from different places. For me, it's like a double-edged sword. When I arrived in the United States, first I should say, you know, I recognize that in contrast to a lot of immigrants in the United States, I have a huge amount of privilege. And that comes from the fact that, you know, I came here from Canada, and I don't appear to be an immigrant in many ways from the outside in terms of what people who might be suspicious of immigrants might be looking for. You know, it's hard to tell by looking at me where I'm from, or that I'm not from the United States, that my family doesn't have a long history here. And so, in a sense, trying to assimilate, you know, from the outside was easy for me. And I tried to do that. I tried to, you know, come here and pretend that I understood this American culture or perception. And the way that I saw it when I arrived wasn't necessarily as a melting pot. I saw it as much more of a rigid kind of Americana culture, what we maybe call patriotism. And I think my first introduction to that was because I landed in high school, as a senior in high school, in a suburban area, in a very white area. And so my first impression of American culture was this sort of unquestioned patriotism, these pep rallies, these football games, which were like a religion to the people who were around me. And even though that felt very foreign to me, I felt like I needed to try as hard as I could to assimilate into that and to pretend that that was my culture and that was my destiny. And it was very rough because I didn't feel that way at all on the inside. But from the outside, I could pretend that I was comfortable. And so for a long time, that's what I did.
And you mentioned in the book, too, you lived for a short time before you came to California and Florida. And there were KKK parades through the town you were living in?
Yeah, this is when I was very, very young. And it was about 1980. And I lived with my parents, like you said, for a short time in Florida. And it had been my first introduction to the South. And my parents, in a way, wanted to do very much the same thing that I ended up wanting to do much later when I arrived in California, which was to assimilate. They had this image of Florida as the good life and a way to kind of escape the weight of their family and all of their roots and connections, and to, drink fresh orange juice and go to the beach on the weekend in our station wagon and go to the drive-in movie theater. That was America. And what eventually drove us out of the South, as my parents tell it, was this sort of very dark and ugly underbelly. We did see KKK marches down our street and through our neighborhood. This was in 1980, you know, people, men and women in white robes marching with signs. And we just, you know, as Jews, that's a very, very weighty thing to see, and it sends a shiver up your neck that I remember now. I was only 3 and 4 years old, and I can remember that as clear as though it was yesterday, and that is why we left.
Now, in addition to assimilation, another major theme of the book is reinvention, and what you refer to at times as metamorphosis and reconstitution. And at one point, you use the, I'm laughing because it was kind of funny the way it came out, the ill-fated Donner Party as a metaphor. And I think most people know the story of expedition of pioneers who came through and met some really bad weather and got into some bad times. And there was rumors of cannibalism. I don't know if that's ever been confirmed. But there's the quote from the book: "Despite the gruesome details, the Donner story comforted me. There were others before me, a caravan of them, who left their past and overcame their presence in a quest for the thing called home. Reinvention was possible. You just had to be willing to consume anything," which I found funny and disturbing at the same time. Is that the price of reinvention?
I think it is. There is absolutely a price to reinvention. There's a price to assimilation, to becoming somebody new, because you lose things. And you also have to give up or deprioritize certain ideals. So for me, I mean, that was... Yes, it's kind of humorous. But the consuming, the idea of consumption and conspicuous consumption is one that that was actually like that was culture shock for me when I arrived in the United States. You know, Canada is so close. We think of it as in some ways is such a very similar country, maybe not as much now after Trump has been elected. And a lot of people make the joke that they can go to Canada. But we do think of it as, you know, a very sort of like a sister culture. But for me, when I arrived in the United States, American consumerism was something that was so different from what I knew around me. When I was growing up in Montreal, and this was in a large, you know, North American urban city, stores were closed on Sundays. Stores closed at 4:30 p.m. If you didn't buy something that you needed, you couldn't get it possibly for 24 or 48 hours. That was just part of that was part of life. And when I arrived in the United States in California, and I was exposed to this culture of consumerism where you can get anything at any time. All you need is money, and you can get anything you want. And I translated that as a message: you can be anyone you want. That was very tantalizing, but also very frightening. So in a sense, I tried to take that on, like as the Donner Party did. They you know, they wanted to come west so badly, not for consumerist purposes, but to start a new life. And I was really, it's a gruesome story, but when I learned it in high school, when I moved to California, I was very comforted by it because I thought to myself, well, if you're determined enough to become someone new and you do anything that's asked of you or required, then you can become that person. And I believe that.
That's just a very interesting metaphor of doing it, but I'm glad you explained that there. Now we talked about the themes of assimilation and reinvention, but maybe even more important in the book is the theme of refusing to be silenced, of bearing witness, of giving testimony to gain control of your own story. Of course, that's what a memoir is all about in a way. And I love your use of the SETI project in the book as a metaphor. SETI is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that was headquartered not too far from where you lived in the Bay Area in Mountain View. The scientists at SETI, you said, were first just trying to detect evidence of alien life just by listening. And then they were, of course, unsuccessful. But then they decided to send out their own signals. And in doing that, you write, the scientist finally found their voice. That's a great analogy for California Calling itself.
Yeah, I think that's true. And thank you for noticing that. Yeah, because of, I think, a combination of things, some experiences that I had when I was young, and my family, sort of actually two different versions of my family kind of fracturing and splintering and then moving to a different culture and having that culture shock. I had a really hard time when I was a young person, a teenager and a college-aged person, what I call, you know, speaking or having my voice. And I felt in a lot of ways like I was silenced. And sometimes that was a physical silence, like I actually couldn't say what I wanted or what I thought or what I needed. And sometimes it felt more like a psychic silencing. And I think the major...
What's a psychic silencing? The first would be kind of like you were intimidated not to speak.
Absolutely. And, you know, for example, I'm at college and I'm in a class and I want to raise my hand and say something, but I physically could not. And now many, many years later, I kind of recognize that as like a social anxiety mm-hmm. type of thing. But I didn't know that at the time. A psychic silencing is more of a... kind of a self-doubt, a lack of confidence, a questioning of my own wants and desires, feeling like I didn't have autonomy or agency over my life or my choices, and allowing that to kind of hamper me, essentially. And so, you know, by making that connection, and I also was very struck by, as an immigrant, I always had paperwork, and there was always paperwork to renew and
forms, yes.
Forms and bureaucracy, and you had to go and you had to appear at this building with your forms, and if you did it wrong, who knows, you could be asked to leave. And so a lot of these papers that I had and took very good care of and monitored very closely had the stamp on them from the United States government that deemed me an alien. And so I thought a lot about that. word alien and what that means and how that relates to feeling alienated. And so, yeah, I've always been interested in the idea of extraterrestrial life and who else is out there, or what else is out there. And so learning that, you know, there were these scientists nearby who spent years and years waiting for a sign of life outside of our planet was really fascinating to me. And then to find out that finally, you know, they decided it wasn't enough to just wait for a signal, that we as humans should begin to project our story outward proactively. That was like a signal to me that maybe, you know, I could do the same, or I should do the same.
Now, you talk in the book about graduating from college, and this was San Francisco State for you, getting a job as a newspaper reporter in Palm Springs. So still in California, but a very different culture than the Bay Area. And you write about this as a new beginning for yourself among several in the book. And here's another great quote. I mean, the book's just full of wonderful, intelligent, wise, and lyrical sentences like this. But beginning again, that to her seems more real. You're talking about yourself here in the third person. It allows a state of revision and opportunity to respond what has come before and to reorient, to correct the record. If our childhood truths were really fictions, to begin again, all we must do to grow up is make more space for myth. And later in the book, you write, to assimilate demands a push through silence, to have our voice silenced and then to bring it back, to lose one myth and build the next, go back, try again, and again, begin again. I'm thinking you see myth here as essential to both growth and assimilation. It kind of unites all the themes in the book.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I realized in a lot of ways, and we all have our mythologies, you know, our personal mythologies and our family mythologies, and that concept of myth and mythology became really important to me as I looked at my own family and my own history and the things that had gone wrong. And it also became important in how I started to look at California, which, you know, had been a place of my obsessions. And we all have our obsessions, whether it's a place or an idea. And just starting to understand that myth or mythology can be very, very empowering because it gives us something to chase after. But there's also something that can happen when we achieve this thing that we want, or when we find ourselves thrust into the mythology, because it's not, you know, it's not always what we think it's going to be. And I'm thinking of, there was a critic who did a review of my book, and what he pointed out that I thought was really fascinating, and I hadn't really thought of it in this way before, but he said, you know, she wants so badly to get to California, and she's chasing after this dream or this myth. And then she gets there, you know, fairly early on in the book, and she doesn't stop chasing it. Yeah, okay, that's right. That's exactly right. And it's, you know, we never stop chasing after these mythologies because, you know, a mythology is never reality. It's always an ideal. And so I think that that can both be dangerous, but it's also a good thing because we need something to believe in. And, you know, once we see that something doesn't turn out the way that we thought that it would, if we can find the next thing to believe in, then we can keep going. And so in a lot of ways, I think that's a metaphor for growing up. And so I use that to kind of weather disappointments and forgive myself for things that didn't go well and keep going and keep striving for the next thing.
Well, it's a beautiful, wise, and lyrical book, Natalie. Thanks so much for talking about it with us and for coming into KABU today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking with Natalie Singer, author of the new memoir, California Calling, A Self-Interrogation, published by Portland's Hawthorne Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Natalie for visiting us at KABU, and to all of you for listening. Yeah,